Hi, everybody. This is Michael Collins for the lunchtime learning call on October 11th on Protect Your Identity. Anybody out there today?
Yep, this is Deb. I'm here.
Hello.
Are you there?
I am.
Okay, good. Now, Michael, is this, while we're reading here, is this is not the same as building blocks, right?
Now, there's two call series. So this is the lunchtime learning, which is designed more to be sort of topical on hot topics for, you know, more seasoned educators who just need to get up to speed on various topics.
Okay.
And then Building Bucks is focused on the basic building blocks of financial education. So it goes through the same 9 topics every year.
Okay.
Just updating them with more recent activities and whatnot.
Okay, I gotcha.
So lunchtime learning is the second Monday, and building blocks is the third Monday. Lunchtime learning is at noon, and building blocks is at 1.
Okay.
The main distinction is that on lunchtime learning, it's a lot of me talking. And on building blocks, it's really led by educators who have worked on a particular topic. So I did send out an email for folks about this call, and on that email is a link to one of the FYI UWEX.edu websites. This one's called Financial Theories, all one word. And on that site is where I try to put topical information as it comes out about all kinds of things, including the topics for these briefs for each of these calls every month. I'm trying to get into a habit of getting these out a little bit earlier. It hasn't happened so far. But you know, you can always look there on that website for the materials, and that's also where you'll find a link to the archives of the phone calls. So those are available as well. But what I'm going to do today is go through the brief on this topic of ID theft, talk a little bit about what some educational opportunities might be around National Protect Your Identity Week, which is next week, October 17th, and then offer some time for discussion, for sharing of ideas for folks on the call who might be trying some innovative ways to get at this topic of identity theft, and maybe tips and tricks that you might want to share with your fellow educators. So any questions or comments before we get going?
So how many people are we talking to here?
On this call?
Yeah.
I don't know. These calls range from a few people to many, but I have no idea to know how many are out there right now.
Okay.
But we'll hear voices come up.
Okay.
So the topic today is identity theft, and I think identity theft is an important topic whether or not you want to be part of National Protect Your Identity Week or not. And it's a topic that certainly has no season to it. I know folks around Extension have worked on issues of identity theft in various contexts, not just the financial context, but I'm going to focus today mostly on the financial context and why it matters so much, particularly around financial information. This is a topic that's constantly changing. If a year ago we had talked about identity theft, there are probably pieces of this I might not have mentioned because the schemes and scams change so fast. And so it's a case of knowing what the most current scam is. I'm going to spend a lot of my time today really focusing on some websites that you should definitely try and explore if you're interested in these topics. There have been some really stellar efforts at the federal level among agencies to get information out about these topics, particularly the Federal Trade Commission, or FTC. But there are other agencies that have done some pretty important work in this area, too. National Protect Your Identity, or whatever, the National Protect Your Identity Week is a effort of the National Foundation for Consumer Credit, which is a coalition of the larger consumer counseling agencies, but it's a collaboration with a number of different organizations around the country. And they developed a nice website, which really, in some ways, just consolidates the other websites that are out there that are useful. So we'll share a little bit of the information about that website and that effort as well. So before I get started, has anybody had an experience actually being a victim of identity theft on the call? This is once you find somebody who's been through this, they can give their testimonial of what the experience is like. You know, the closest I've come is actually having somebody list my credit card number and make a bunch of charges for concert tickets in London, but pretty quickly the card company caught it. But I haven't had anything beyond that. But it's for people who've been through it, it's a very devastating experience to go through. So there are some things that can be done in terms of prevention, but there's also knowing what to do when it happens to you, because even all the prevention in the world can't prevent some of these cases. So I guess first just starting with this idea of what is identity theft, you know, the most important thing to remember is that it's a crime. You know, that someone stealing information from you and using it for their own gain is a crime, and it's a prosecutable crime, and in some cases can get people heavy jail time. It is increasingly a crime that engages international crime syndicates, where information is bought and sold on these sort of underground markets, which makes your information even more valuable as that information is bought and sold and traded. Some of this is more sort of petty, you know, somebody gets your credit card number, it's sort of akin to the old check fraud or forgery, something like that. But it's becoming a much more sophisticated crime. And as we become more dependent on electronic versions of accounts and information, the ramifications of identity theft are becoming worse and worse. I mean, imagine in the next week how many times you might do transactions using technology tools like the internet or your cell phone or your credit card number over the telephone, those kinds of things. And if you couldn't do that, and or even worse, if you thought somebody else was using that information for their own gain, you know, it's becoming a bigger and bigger issue. It's become more sort of meshed with these technologies that are out there. Identity theft varies in terms of what it might involve. So check fraud used to be a pretty common one. Credit card fraud we see a lot of. We actually see entire financial identities stolen. So people might use your information to actually take out a loan in your name without you even knowing it. We saw some of this during the mortgage boom where people had loans taken out in their name. They didn't even know. Sometimes people want your identity because their own identity is tarnished, so they're trying to, you know, escape and hire, you know, use your identity to protect their own. Sometimes people use the information to make fraudulent claims against insurance or against public programs. So there's just lots and lots of different variances out there, and they move fast. It's a pretty common experience. About 10 million people a year, this is from FTC data, are estimated to experience some form of identity theft or identity fraud, and it's growing. We see more and more cases each year. It's costly. People end up losing money because even though many accounts have protections on them, they're not 100%. And it's certainly costly in terms of time. One statistic I found on one of the FTC websites was that a victim might spend about 30 hours calling companies, fixing problems, sending letters, dealing with frozen credit, all those kinds of things. So it is expensive, both in terms of time and energy and aggravation and stress, and actual dollars too. It's important to remember that while oftentimes in the media you get a lot of information about the sophisticated crime syndicates that are involved in financial fraud or in identity theft, you know, in 16% of cases, at least in one survey, it was actually somebody that knew the person. So a family member, a friend, a neighbor who stole information and used it for their own gain. So it's not just these sophisticated criminals. It can also just be, you know, simply stealing information from somebody that knows you or having somebody steal information from you. What's also important is that sometimes these are relatively nuanced kinds of things that are happening. So somebody might be using your credit card for a few small amounts here and there. Somebody might be using your information to make a claim on insurance, those kinds of things. And you may have no idea what's going on. About a quarter of cases, people who are victims of identity theft don't find out until something triggers and they start to dig deeper and then they realize, uh-oh, something's gone wrong. So about a quarter of cases, they don't figure it out for 6 months until after it begins. You know, in my case, when I had a credit card number stolen, the credit card company actually contacted me and said, you know, suddenly there's all these charges being made from London, even though you live in Wisconsin. That seems kind of strange. And so we, you know, quickly were able to put a stop to it. But if the credit card company or some other company's not watching, and you're not watching, it can continue for quite a while. So when we talk about identity theft, what's this valuable information that's out there? And the obvious one is Social Security numbers. Hopefully you've all heard enough times that you shouldn't keep your social security card in your wallet. You shouldn't keep anything on you or that's easily accessible that has your social security number on it. That number is the key to opening up lots of information. It's the way that accounts are verified, that government records are verified. So it's a number that just shouldn't be shared. Well, a lot of us know that. About a year ago, we had a workshop with folks from the Social Security Administration, and they made the point about not carrying your Social Security card in your wallet. And, of course, I knew that already. But then they made the point about other Social Security numbers that you might have in your wallet. And I realized, you know, I personally had my kids' Social Security numbers written down on the back of a business card in my wallet because I needed them for something and stuck them in there. It was convenient occasionally. And I realized that's just as dangerous as having my own. So not just your own Social Security number, but those of other people that you might be, you know, you may not have memorized and you have written down someplace. So keeping those secure as well, not a good idea to keep anything like that on you. Other information, you know, birthday. Date of birth is another one of those verifications. And a lot of times people in this field talk about the three, you know, combinations of three information that can identify you. And Social Security and birth date and your name or address or, you know, one other third piece of information, driver's license number, something like that. And people can crack most of your information. So it's this sort of magic three combinations of Social Security, birth date, plus something else. And the something else can be pretty minor, and people can get a lot of information about you. And birthdays aren't that hard to find on people. You know, if you've ever been to a Facebook page, you oftentimes see people put their birth date right there, and it's available. And it's not hard to find their address, so you know you can start to find these pieces of information pretty easily. Obviously, account numbers, bank account numbers, investment account numbers, those are important to safeguard. You know, bank account numbers on the bank statement, on checks themselves, that's usually not enough information. That so the check itself isn't necessarily a risk. But, you know, the bank, particularly the account number and sub-accounts can be more risky, similarly with the investment accounts. Obviously, debit and credit cards, I mean, it's not hard once you have a debit or credit card to make charges online or on the phone or you know in other ways without actually having a physical card. The key thing on those is, you know, certainly anytime you make a charge, though the last four digits may be available, but the you know the first string of numbers you want to make sure never goes on a receipt or never sort of is out there and available. I've heard of people leaving those in their cars, you know, so they buy something and they get the receipt that has their number on it, they leave it in their car and then somebody swipes it out of their car. So that kind of thing can be dangerous. But the other important thing is more and more cards now have security codes in addition to the 16-digit string they had before, depending on the card, 3- or 4-digit code. That's something else to protect. And without that, it's harder to make charges than it used to be. But still, you know, having somebody lift your credit card or debit card is something to watch. There are certainly scams we've heard about where, you know, machines like at gas pumps may be designed to steal your swipe. You know, particularly for debit cards or at airports, people who, you know, may be using their credit card for making a phone call or for doing something else can have their credit card number stolen. Typing it onto a website, maybe if you're in an airport and you're trying to buy internet access, so you type in your card number, somebody could be looking over your shoulder, that kind of thing. So lots of ways that you can imagine that these numbers get stolen. More and more people now are using electronic payment systems like PayPal or direct electronic funds transfers. Those electronic accounts are dangerous. I mean, obviously, just like the accounts I just talked about, like a credit or debit account, you don't want to let that information out. But what's important about some of these electronic transfer accounts, like a PayPal account, is they often not only do they charge, so let's say, for example, you were trying to make a PayPal payment out of your bank account, and then PayPal set up, if your bank account for some reason bounces or doesn't work or the bank rejects it, they have a backup source. And so these accounts are dangerous because you get access not only to the main one, but to the backup one. And you start to get, you know, more and more information. I've had somebody call me once and tell me about their situation where they had an iTunes account that somebody hacked into, and then somebody made all the charges out of their iTunes account. It drained their bank account, and then it flipped over to their credit card, and it, you know, drained, you know, ran up a big bill on their credit card because it's designed to do this. So those accounts are particularly important to safeguard and keep safe or not use it, but they make you nervous. There's another set of information which sort of is termed verifying information, but this is, you've probably all had this experience, you're on the phone with some company and you give them some information and they say, oh, can you verify your information by telling us your place of birth or your maiden name, your parents' middle name, the phone number of where you grew up, your last two addresses, those kinds of things. And so that information, while it seems kind of innocuous and, you know, who cares about that, can be very valuable to somebody trying to steal your identity because they may have partial information or have some other holes in what they have. But if they get on the phone with a customer agent and the customer agent wants to verify and then they can start to provide this kind of stuff, the customer agent might be able to provide them more clues, more information that could give away information. Internet account passwords, you know, you all know that you should come up with passwords that are a variation of capital letters, small letters, some non-characters, you know, like percentage signs or those kinds of things, numbers, of course, which makes it very hard to remember those passwords. And so what a lot of us do is we write it down on a piece of paper. So, you know, I can walk around our office here and see people who have a little post-it next to the computer with all their passwords on it. It's very tempting to do that because as we make the passwords harder and harder to remember, we don't remember them ourselves. And so we end up just basically betraying the whole password system. So, again, people can't do that and have to think about ways to come up with a system where they can remember these things and not have to have them written down someplace they can get retrieved. Driver's license numbers, this is probably less of an issue than it used to be. Most driver's license numbers now are not used for very many transactions. Sometimes they're written on checks, but it is still something that needs to be safeguarded. And where a driver's license number can become more of a problem is when somebody's trying to defraud insurance or, you know, maybe a public program where that becomes important. And then a relatively newcomer on the scene are medical records and insurance information. You may have seen press in the last couple of years about the huge Medicare and other frauds that have taken place where some fraudulent company will set up patients to be received, you know, they'll billing on a regular basis for some sort of in-home service or for oxygen or for some, you know, medical treatment that costs thousands of dollars a year, but the cases are all fraudulent. The patient, they just stole information from patients. They're billing Medicaid, Medicare, these other services for, you know, and the numbers I've seen are huge, millions and millions of dollars a year is a fraud in this way. And the way they do it is they get, you know, the basic information about somebody and then their medical record. That's enough to verify where they're at. You know, that this is somebody who plausibly could get this kind of service, and then they could start to run up those insurance bills. So medical fraud is becoming a growing area of concern and sort of one of the new issues to become more cautious about. How does identity fraud, how do you become a victim of identity fraud? What's the thieves' techniques or tactics? Well, you know, despite everything you've heard about the various technological wonders of hackers and viruses and all those kinds of things, the number one source is still losing a wallet or having your wallet stolen. You know, the old-fashioned, you know, not take your money out of your wallet, but take all the information that's in your wallet and use it against you. So, you know, obviously this comes back to the making sure that your wallet has a minimal amount of information in it that can be identified. You know, most of us forget about what's in our wallet. We just keep accumulating. You know, there's probably some combination of information in your wallet right now, which could be dangerous. And so it's just a matter of, on a regular basis, cleaning it out, making sure that the stuff's in there is what you really need, and not having stuff in there that you don't need. You know, the thing about wallets is that people take them everywhere. There's a high chance of it getting stolen or they get lost. So it's just one of those things that's very easy for somebody to do something nefarious with. So keeping track of that information in alternative ways and, you know, basic protection of that information is a key thing. Another important source, again, this isn't particularly high tech, is sort of the old-fashioned dumpster diving. Somebody goes through your trash and finds information that they can use. So paper documents of various kinds, you know, those bank statements or credit card statements, those kinds of things are going to be really key. You've probably received emails where people say, oh, if you just give me this information, I'll transfer money to your account, or there's some problem with your account, and yet the email address seems totally bogus. Those scams are getting more and more sophisticated, where the fraudsters make their emails and their website look just like what you've come to think the real sites look like. Good sites have begun having customized pages so that there's a symbol or something that shows up on the page so you know it's authentic. But essentially what the emails or websites are trying to do is get you to type in some information about you that then can be resold or used in some kind of scam. Just like the websites and the emails, though, there are people that will call up and they'll say, oh, I'm so-and-so and I'm from such-and-such a firm and there's a problem with your account. And, you know, you, of course, are alarmed about that. You want to solve whatever the problem is. And it's hard to know whether this is real or not. And then they start to ask you for information. Oh, can you just verify your Social Security number and a couple other things? And, you know, once somebody asks for your Social Security number, they call you and ask for your Social Security number, you know it's a scam because no reputable place would ever call you and ask you for that kind of information. But it's, you know, it's a scam, and it's particularly one that seems to be where people prey upon elderly folks and try to get that information out of them over the phone. So it's an important thing to let people know that whenever anybody calls you and asks for personal information, you basically say no or hang up. If it's real, they'll find some other way to get in touch with you. You know, obviously, we've all heard a lot about Facebook and these social networking sites and people who reveal too much information about all, in all kinds of ways. But it's important, too, the financial stuff. You know, that you may not put your bank account or Social Security number on there, but you may have your birthday, where you work, where you're at, where you have been the last, you know, few weeks, maybe any health issues. And some of these websites, they actually track your physical location, so somebody could know if you're home or not, and if you're not home, if they could steal your mail or some other piece of information. So these sites are just something to be really cautious about and think about the combination of public information that might be out there that somebody could use to steal your identity. Another big issue that's becoming, you know, that's rising on the list of how the tactics and strategies that thieves use is the cell phone. More and more people now are using cell phones and text messages and those kinds of things to share information with maybe do online banking or maybe to do other kinds of things. Or maybe it's just information about them personally that's in there. And when you get a new phone, and many people are getting a new phone every year or every 2 years, where does that old phone go? Does it sit in a store someplace that somebody can grab, or does it go to a recycling center where somebody could take information off of it? So it's important to go through a process of really cleaning off those old phones or PDAs before they get any place that you don't have control over them. The same is true for laptops and computers. You probably know that just erasing a file or a set of files from your computer or laptop does not mean they're not there. It means that the sort of map to them in the computer is no longer there, but the information is still there and it can still be retrieved. So there's, you know, these so-called erased machines aren't really erased. They really have to have the hard drive or memories removed or cleared, completely taken down so that there's no way the information can be taken. And then you sometimes hear about these large-scale computer breaches. So this is where somebody hacks into a database and steals information on tens of thousands of individuals. Sometimes it's less sophisticated than that. Some worker had all the account information on their laptop, and they were someplace, and they left the laptop, and somebody picked it up, or the laptop got stolen. So most institutions now are getting tighter and tighter about information on mobile machines, having that all locked down so it can't be stolen or used against anybody. We still hear about computer breaches. Just in the last couple of weeks, we heard one of a financial institution database that was hacked into, and the records were stolen by some international syndicate. So computer breaches still happen. The odds are much more likely that you're going to have a lost or stolen wallet or even dumpster diving than you're going to be a victim of one of these large-scale computer breaches. But the large-scale computer breaches get in the news. And so people tend to focus on those, you know, these, and they're horrific kind of events when they happen. But, you know, that those are kind of things it's hard to have any control over. They're big news, but, you know, the best thing you can do is make sure you secure your basic information. Don't get into trouble with your paper documents. The last thing is we've seen recently where, particularly this is more on the medical side, where maybe an office is discarding their old copier, getting, you know, upgrading to the new copy machine. And today's copiers, many of them actually have an image sensing and storage system so they can actually create PDFs or other forms of information. And if somebody got a hold of that copier, they could download information, figure out everything that got copied. So you can imagine, you know, like my healthcare provider copies all my personal information once a year. So if somebody got a hold of that copier, they'd have all the personal information for all these people, all these patients over the course of a year. It could be thousands of people. So this, you know, the storage and disposal of photocopiers has become a more important topic of late. So what is, you know, people often want to know what happens to their information. It's hard to know. I mean, certainly sometimes what you see is just, you know, somebody locally gets the information and they try to buy some stuff and they use it, but that's not, you know, that's not always what happens. Oftentimes what happens is that people are stealing information so that they can sell it on these sort of underground marketplaces. That you can go online and you can find, you know, these typically offshore kinds of enterprises where they'll sell you lists of information, of personal information, where you can, you know, use that information to try to cull through and find some scheme to try to victimize people with. So those lists have great value, and it's the sort of buying and selling and trading of this personal information that's really caused a great increase in the number of identity thefts that are out there. It's hard to know, of course, when you're a victim of some of these identity fraud kind of situations. Some signals to look for, and you know, not everybody always looks at their credit card or bank statements every month, but when you see small purchases or small, even sometimes deposits in a bank account, that can be a signal that something's going on. So they might be, you know, $1.50 or, you know, real small things that you sort of, you might somehow think to yourself, oh, I must have forgotten about that. But those might actually just be a thief trying to test the waters and see if they can get away with anything. Typically, you'll see a few small kind of purchases or, you know, deposits and then some big ones. And the kinds of things they tend to buy, so like in my case, it was somebody buying concert tickets to an event in London. They bought like six concert tickets. So those are hard to trace back to the buyer, and they can immediately sell those, you know, to somebody else once the event's gone. There's really no way to do anything about that, the value of that. So it tends to be the kind of things that happen where they buy things that are quickly sold and can't be traced, as opposed to, you know, some hard item that could be tracked down. You know, some of the other scams we've seen are, you know, stealing information to try to take out a loan. You know, we saw a lot of scams where very dilapidated homes during the housing boom were being bought with big loans that, you know, some appraiser was in cahoots to create some artificial value, stole somebody's identity to take out a loan, never made a payment, the bank foreclosed, but all the money that was used in the transaction went to, you know, whoever the scam artist was. So they might take out a $300,000 loan, put all the money in their pocket. They only paid a small fraction for what the property was really worth. The poor borrower never knew that their name was used in the transaction because it was all fraud. And, you know, there's just multiple cases of that. That's one of the most growing areas that the Financial Crimes Unit has been finding at the federal level, as these sort of mortgage-related scams and frauds. But another one, as I mentioned before, is medical claims. These mark false medical claims, especially around Medicare and Medicaid. But also for private insurance too. I mean, these are a scheme too, where you know, millions of dollars might be stolen. So you know, as I sit here, I'm sure there are other schemes being drawn up, and you know, if we have this call again in a year or more, we'll have identified even more of these kind of things that are out there. What's actually done with the information doesn't change the sort of the protection and prevention steps, which I think are really, that's the key message. It's, you know, taking care of what you need to do to not become a victim of identity theft. So I put in the brief just some basic things to keep in mind, things like, you know, like I said, on your credit card, or your Social Security card, don't keep it in your wallet, and don't keep other identification numbers in your wallet, including the Social Security numbers of people in your family. You know, don't write your Social Security number on anything, on a check, on an account, anything like that. You just don't want to have that information available. You know, one of the ways that people steal information about you would be to steal your mail. So to know that you don't come home till after 5, know that the mailman drops off the mail at your house at 2, so they have 3 hours to comb through it really quickly, see if there's one item they can steal from it that might have a bank's address, return address on it, and maybe they'll get lucky. Likewise, if you're sending out checks or sending out statements, sometimes those statements have a lot of information about you. the account number, your account information, particularly if you're doing electronic transfer and you're mailing information about that. Those are the kinds of things you just want to mail at the post office or put in a box and not leave in your mailbox, because, again, somebody could steal that in between the time that you leave it and the postal person comes to pick them up. You know, as much as I said in the beginning that there's some risk to using online bill payment, in some ways not having the physical checks and transfers can be an advantage too. So, you know, cautious and careful use of EFT, which is the electronic funds transfer, for incoming checks and payments, it can be a useful tool. Having a check mailed to your house and sitting there can be something, again, that somebody could steal. They could try to forge it and cash it themselves, or they could use the information in that particular check to try to use against you in some way. As I said before, you know, coming up with a system, cull your wallet to keep it thin and make sure that you don't accumulate stuff in there that could be used in some combination to use against you. You know, and then watching your statements. You know, there's no item on your statement that's too small. And I think that's something people say, I don't remember buying that particular thing. Well, if you don't remember it, particularly if the location doesn't seem consistent with some place you've been, then you need to immediately call it and try to do something about it. Most financial firms have teams that this is their job. When you call and say, I suspect something's going on, they immediately launch an investigation. Oftentimes they'll take action within hours or, you know, within a couple of days. This is something that most financial institutions, credit card companies, other firms, online retailers are extremely worried about and will take action if you make that call. Obviously, don't provide financial information over the phone or other personal information over the phone, especially if somebody calls you. But even if you call them and you feel pretty secure about the information, you generally shouldn't have to provide your whole Social Security number. You know, generally, if they ask you for that, say, can I just provide you with the last four, those kinds of things, because there's no need to, last four digits, I mean, no need to make that information more public than you need to. Shredding, that's a big one. One of the biggest events, or most fun events probably around the Protect Your Identity Week is going to be these big shredding events where a shredder is set up and people can get their personal information shredded. It turns out that a lot of the shredders that were sold, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, weren't very good. They left pretty wide bands. Usually they would just shred into individual strips. And those individual strips were sometimes wide enough that you could still piece them together and get information out of them. Today, shredders are better. They tend to do thinner strips, and sometimes they do both long ways and cross ways. So you end up with confetti as opposed to strips. So shredding is important, you know, when in doubt, shred. And, you know, not only ripping it up is not sufficient. So you're really having some kind of tool that can get the information really shredded up. And then, you know, if going to someplace to have it shredded makes it easier and faster or convenient or more likely for you to do it, then that's a great way to go. Credit reports. Three times a year, and we've talked about this in Building Bucks and on these calls as well, three times a year you can get your credit report from each credit bureau. We can get it once from each bureau once a year. So three times a year, there's three bureaus. You can get your credit report. You know, oftentimes we tell people to do this because they should just keep an eye on their credit and know where they're at. But it's also important for identity fraud. Make sure that there's nothing in there that isn't you or that you don't recognize. So as you look at that credit report, have an eye towards not only how you're doing, but also if that information is accurate, there might be any signals in there that something's going wrong. Obviously, don't respond to emails or websites that ask you for personal information. You just can't know unless you've signed in and have some way to verify that everything is actually going to the place where you think it is, and you just shouldn't do it. Didn't talk a whole lot about antivirus, but clearly there are some sophisticated viruses out there that are designed to try to steal information from you. So having an anti-spyware or a firewall, those kinds of things on your computers are important. And there's actually a website that the federal government has called On Guard Online, which talks about some strategies around these kinds of things. Obviously, they're not going to recommend a specific brand of software for antivirus protection, but just more strategies and thinking about to make sure that you're covered against these potential problems. Passwords, as I said before, you want to make sure your passwords are things that you can remember without having to write them down, but are hard to guess. and, you know, birth dates and spouse's name and kid's name. Those are the obvious ones. But, you know, trying to make sure they're not things that, that people could guess. I've seen studies where, you know, somebody who knows you can guess your password within usually like 3 or 4 tries in a lot of cases. So even mixing it up with a non-characters or numbers, those kinds of things to make sure that, and then also changing them every once in a while. And you can go through a regular cycle where you, you know, sometimes you put an exclamation mark at the beginning or in the middle or at the end or, you know, so that you're changing them on a regular basis. And then obviously be careful about anybody who calls you and says, oh, there's a problem with your account. You need to tell me some information about your account. Those are kind of obvious scams to be aware of. So what happens if you're a victim or if you have a client or a colleague who's a victim? You know, I think you'll find lots of information online about different strategies. In Wisconsin, there is an Office of Privacy Protection. I put the 1-800 number and the email address in the brief, so you can find that. That would be an important step. They will oftentimes help people by guiding them in terms of what they should do next. One of the things I would say is generally a good idea is to file a complaint at the FTC website. That's the Federal Trade Commission, FTC.gov, and I left the site in the brief. There's a form there that you can fill out, and then that form is the filing of a complaint. You can also print that form and take that complaint to your local police department so that they know the case is open, particularly if it's a case where you think the fraud was done by somebody locally or somebody stole your information locally. So that you at least have a police record on it. Sometimes if you have information and you might make a claim for insurance, then, you know, the police claim may be, the complaint with the police department may be critical for your ability to file a claim with your insurance if you had some loss that you want to protect yourself from. Then we get into, well, what do I do if I think somebody has my credit information? So the first thing you can do is something called a fraud alert. And if you call any one of the three credit bureaus, the credit bureau reporting companies, and I put all three bureaus' information in the brief, including their website and their address and phone number. If you call any one of them and say, I think I may be a victim of fraud, I've lost my card, or there's something going on, they will immediately contact the other two agencies so that you essentially have a fraud alert put on your card. A fraud alert basically is a warning for the credit bureaus and a warning to you that something may be happening. You can monitor your credit more frequently if you're in a fraud alert status. It doesn't freeze your accounts. Your accounts are still active. You can still make charges. You can still use your accounts. It's not the same as a freeze. A freeze is the next level of scrutiny. States vary in their use of the credit freeze. Wisconsin does allow a security freeze or a credit freeze, and there's a website here where you can look at the information about security freeze in Wisconsin. It's a state law that allows you to do this, and there's other states that allow you to do this too. It essentially will require the credit bureaus to check in with you on various activities. They will not share information with each other, so you actually have to call each credit bureau and tell them. It's not like a fraud alert, so you have to call each of the three. You have to make 3 calls or put in 3 alerts with each of the bureaus so that you can get the security freeze in place. And then when you want to do something with your account, you actually have to contact the bureau and tell them, okay, this is a transaction I want to do. It's okay. So it's much more, whereas the fraud alert is just, you know, almost an informational kind of thing. The freeze really requires you to take some action in order to do things. You can put it on and take it off. You usually have to take it off in writing. In Wisconsin, there's a $10 charge for each agency. So if you wanted to put a freeze on all three credit bureaus, that would be $30 total, $10 per agency. Now, in Wisconsin, you can have that $10 fee waived if you have a valid police report that says you're a victim of identity theft. So there is at least one mechanism there when you have the police report to avoid those kinds of charges. But this is, you know, a freeze is a pretty drastic measure. So you'd only want to use, the alert, I think, is a pretty simple thing. And if you think that your information's been stolen, you want to put the alert on, and then that gives you increased access and, you know, more verification of what's going on in your account. The freeze is really locking down your account, essentially. And you only want to do that if you've been the victim of fraud and you think there might be expanding fraud. So, you know, let's say that you had your medical identity identity stolen and somebody was making insurance claims using your information, but they hadn't touched your credit report yet, but you think there's a high risk that they might try to do something with your credit card, take out an account or something like that in your name, then you might want to put a freeze in, and that essentially locks down your account, and you can't have any new accounts opened or activity on it. So a freeze would be a little more drastic of a step, and I think for most people, the fraud alert is a good enough step to just be aware of what's going on and try to fix up the damage that took place. Cell phones and computers, I mean, this is becoming a bigger and bigger issue as people have more information on their phones. It turns out that resetting a cell phone is harder. I mean, I wish I could just tell you there's a magic button on your cell phone. There is, but it varies for every machine. So PC Magazine, I put a link in here for the various routines you have to go through with each kind of cell phone to reset them. And they really do scrub the identity on the cell phone clean, or the PDA clean. So, but it's a certain procedures that you have to go through to do that. Computers and things with hard drives, so laptops and computers, you know, things that can't be reset, like a cell phone or a PDA can't be. You know, certainly you'll find software and you'll find vendors who say they can delete and clean a hard drive. But I've also seen some information out there that says that even those may not completely clean. And so what most offices or most businesses say is that the only safe thing to do is remove the hard drive and physically destroy it. So if you were going to give away your machine, your laptop or your computer or recycle it, you would first pull out the hard drive and destroy it and not include it with the machine. So that seems a little bit drastic, and I've actually not been in a situation where I've had to dispose of a machine like that, but that's sort of the current advice, is to just get the hard drive separated from the machine and destroy it in some way physically so that there's no chance of losing the information. So I said as we started that I wanted to get share some of the websites that are out there, and I would encourage you to spend, you know, 5 or 10 minutes just looking at these. There's really, unlike a lot of other issues in personal finance, there's really good, objective, trustworthy, quality information on the internet. So you can find some great information out there. I would say this Identity Theft Resource Center, which is idtheftcenter.org, is one good place. It's a bit of they basically are a gathering spot for information from across other reputable sites, but they're reputable themselves, so most of their links are to good information and solid information, and so that's a good resource to use. It's a nonprofit organization; they are not trying to sell some kind of a service that might be trying to teach people. The National Protect Your Identity Week actually has a website, which is pretty good. It's called protectyouridentitynow.org. This is something developed by the National Foundation for Consumer Credit with its partners to support the October 17th, Protect Your Identity Week, October 17th through 23rd. There are a number of events taking place across the country for Protect Your Identity Week, and if you go to that website and you click on the map, you can click on Wisconsin, you'll see there's events in Appleton and Eau Claire and Madison and Milwaukee, Sheboygan, and then other places. So most of these are Shred events. Cintas, which is a big national company that does uniforms and other business services, are bringing out their big shredding trucks, and we'll let people shred their personal information. It's basically a shredder day each day of the week for Protect Your Identity Week. The site also has a number of links to other sites that have identity theft information on them, some government agencies, some nonprofit agencies, as well as some consumer information and some videos, which might be useful in an educational setting, and some quiz questions and some other things that might be useful. So, and I encourage you to look at that site, especially if you're thinking about doing something around Identity Theft Week. It may be too late to get engaged if there's already an event in your community, but it might be something to think about for next year. They do this every year. So it's a site definitely I would recommend, just to get some general background, as well as, you know, to maybe get involved in events for future years. Another site that I highly recommend is the FTC, Federal Trade Commission. They're probably the leader at the federal government level on identity fraud. There have been presidential commissions and other commissions put out to try to really get at issues of fraud and how we get the information to the public, but the FTC has a whole set of materials designed for consumers, designed for people who've been victims of theft. But maybe of most interest to you all is they have community education materials. So they have brochures that are ready to go. They have PowerPoint shows that are ready to go. So, you know, as an educator, you could go to that website, get the information, even tinker with it to include your own, information that you might want to do about your own events and local resources and that kind of thing, and use it. So it's a great resource. They're totally free. It's, you know, supported by the federal government. They want to get the information out there. They want you to use it. You don't have to worry about copyright or cost or anything like that. It's really designed to support you to do this kind of work. So it's a great site to look at and certainly one that you might want to explore as well. So with that, I know we're getting towards the end of the time, so I just want to make sure that if people have any questions or comments, if they've gone through experiences. If you yourself have done any education around identity theft, you might want to share tips and tricks and techniques, that kind of thing.
Michael, this is Nancy Crevier in Marinette County. Can you talk a little bit about password safes, the online password safes?
I actually don't know anything about that.
Oh, I just recently read that there are, and they're online, they're websites that are set up that will help you manage your passwords and keep track of them and identify when it's time to change passwords and help you through that process. I was just wondering how, you know, what the recommendations are on that.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm not that computer savvy, but it sounds like a great idea and something I could use. And it certainly is better than keeping the Post-it note stuck to your desk.
Nancy, this is Gail Pope. You might want to go to your IT department because they actually did some training for us.
Oh, okay, great. I was looking for more personal things, but I can check with them just to see if they have any experience with it.
Well, actually, I did. I taught identity theft last week as part of the Money Smart Week, and I talked to IT on making sure that I'm just current on some of.
Right.
Yeah. So we.
Good idea, Gail.
So is there, when you taught the identity theft last week, is there anything that you want to share about what worked well? Or?
Well, actually, I did a PowerPoint several years ago, and I just updated that. I think everything that you said is pretty much what I talked about. The new was the medical fraud, and FTC has that on their website. And also a question I got, which is also on the FTC website, was on should I buy insurance or not to pre, you know, a lot of companies are marketing insurance to prevent identity theft, and there is a site on there to buy or not to buy. So that was a question. What would you have to add to that information? Any comments?
So basically you're paying a fee to buy an insurance that protects you against any losses that you might take?
Correct.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so I'd have to figure out what the terms of the insurance were. On credit cards, you're limited. If you report it, you're limited to a
$50 right.
liability, which I'm guessing the insurance premium is probably more than that over time. You know, other forms of identity theft that, you know, maybe using your bank account, those kind of things, I guess those really wouldn't be covered, but most institutions will work with you.
I got a question last week about that, and I didn't really have an answer for them because they said, well, all the time that, you know, as you alluded to, the amount of time it takes to track everything you've done, and I mean, it takes a lot of if people are victims of identity theft, it's very time-consuming.
Yeah.
And they were thinking of that perspective.
Yeah. You know, I actually don't know about a sort of real insurance against this, and, you know, I don't know whether maybe even some people's homeowners, and, you know, those policies might cover them in some cases. I do know that there are these, I don't know, I'm thinking of one particular company, which is LifeLock, but there's other ones that are like them. But I've certainly, everything I've read about these companies is that they really are a scam. They're not doing anything that you can't do yourself, but
yeah.
You're paying a monthly fee for it. It's not really an insurance. It's more like they're just doing the same kind of credit checking and kind of things you can do yourself anyway.
That's what I was kind of looking for, but I didn't have that answer. I didn't have an answer for them. And I said I'd get back to them.
Yeah.
So LifeLock is what you said?
LifeLock is one, and it's not really an insurance. It's a monthly, like you pay a monthly fee so that they monitor your credit for you. But you can do that yourself. I mean, it's not, like a lot of these things, I don't know what the value added is.
Well, that's what I'm saying, because I think they are scams. So just say I was a little bit hesitant to recommend anything. I'd say a lot of it, you have to read the fine print.
Yeah.
But some of these things, they're not going to do what you really can do. And like the LifeLock, I hadn't heard of that. I'll have to check into that.
Yeah, that's one I've definitely heard, that you're just paying a fee to do.
Okay.
It's not sure there's any added value out of that.
Benefit, yeah. Okay, thanks.
This is Peggy in Richland, and I have another question or situation. I had been working with an elderly woman who had heard from her insurance company that there was something going on with her credit report. So she got a copy of her credit reports for the first time and found that there was a collections and an eviction on two of her reports based on someone with the same name down in Chicago. So and the woman had lived in her house for 50 years here in Richland County. So I guess my question is, so when is it where, you know, the credit bureaus have mixed up information maybe with somebody with the same name, and how do you know when somebody's out there using your name?
So this is a case where they just literally swapped information. I mean, it's more of a bureaucratic mistake.
I mean, how would a person know that?
Know the difference.
Yeah.
I think you have to assume that it's theft. I mean, I'm not saying that what your case wasn't just a mix-up, but I think you generally have to just say, look, you have to assume it's theft and then sort of build yourself from there. You know, I've seen some cases where people have had, say their parents or their kids' credit information on their credit report, but I've very rarely heard of where, you know, there's two Joan Smiths and they get their account mixed up, because most of the credit bureau data is actually done by numbers, not by your actual name. It's more of they use a social security number, some other numbers to do the account stuff. So, in those cases, I think you can contact the bureau and probably get a lot of the, you know, whatever the problem is taken care of, or each of the three bureaus if it's spread across all three of them. But, you know, I guess I would, my only hesitation here is if people start to think, well, maybe that's just a mix-up, maybe I'm not too worried about it. They should worry about it, and they should, you know, pretend like it is fraud and try to act aggressively, you know, maybe even doing an alert in a case where it's just a mix-up.
Okay, well, that's good to know. I know she spent like 6 months getting it straightened out and proving she was her, but
wow.
Neither one of us even thought about filing a police report with something like that, because we just thought they mixed up records. But that's good to know.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible that that's the case, but you want to be careful. Other questions or other people who've had experience teaching this kind of stuff or issues that clients have brought up? Is anybody involved in Protect Your Identity Week? Well, I was, you know, trying to look at the website and see if there's anything going on in your community that you can piggyback off of maybe next year. Or at the very least, take your personal information and shred it. It'd probably be fun to see it go through one of these giant, you know, it's like a tree shredder size shredder. So. All right, any further questions, comments? Okay, thanks everybody. Have a great week.
Bye.